Okay. Now, the exam two analyses haven't been graded yet because we just got home too, right? Just got back, I mean. It's home for us. What? Can they hear me in the back? No? Okay. All right. How about that? Now you can, can't you? I'm going to talk softly today. So I'm turning this way up. And you're okay. So. Hi. I'm not projecting today because... But I'm happy that you all got back. Welcome back. And that you're all caught up. So, while you were watching movies, I was enjoying Phoenix, which was 80 degrees and sunny for all the time that I was there, and they were projecting that for another week after I left. Nice city. And when you were watching the second video, I was in Albuquerque. I thought about you that afternoon about the time you finished class. I went to the zoo with three grandchildren, so I was having fun. The price I paid was that I came back with a nasty cold, which is why I'm not speaking very loudly, because if I do, I will lose control of my voice, which I'm determined to hang on to. Okay. So, do we have any announcements? yes, we would like to announce the recent birth of Julie's new nephew, Noah. And she got to welcome Noah over the break. So she's very happy to be an aunt again. And the exam two analyses aren't finished yet because I was away and I just got them yesterday. So I will deal with them soon. Are there any other announcements or questions about details? I do need to ask you a question or two, so let me start with this. We have four classes, including today, and a week from Wednesday, which is our last class, we will have a review session after class, if you want one. And it occurred to us today that since the exam is more than a week after that last class, that perhaps you would rather wait and have another review session later. So give that about 3 seconds thought, and I'll ask you how many of you would like to have the review session immediately after class a week from Wednesday. How many of you don't care? Okay. How many of you would prefer not to? Okay. We will schedule two other review sessions before the exam, and I'll have to look at my schedule, and I'll come with some proposed dates and times and see if we can make it possible for everybody to get to at least one, if you want to come to one. Okay. The final, while we're on that nasty topic, as long as I've got a nasty cold, we might as well talk about exams, right? The exam will be here or in Fleming, although I'm not sure I got confirmation of that. Would you remind me to check? So those of you who have taken both of your exams in here will not take the final here, but we'll tell you where to go. The exam is a little bit longer than the other two, more points, more multiple choice questions, same number of essays. Right. Okay. 3 out of 4 essays and more multiple choice. It covers this unit primarily, but like the other one, asks you to connect the material from this unit to the previous two units. So now you get 3 units, the whole lifespan, all 3 domains, and see if you can put it all together. Okay. Other housekeeping questions? Yes. Are we going to go over the writing assignment? Hang on a minute. I just need to warn you that part of the problem I'm having with my cold is that the airplane descents, all 3 of them, managed to plug up both Eustachian tubes badly, so I can't hear, which it was very interesting. You know, kind of like one of those simulation exercises. So I'm being semi-deaf. And it really does change your perspectives in some wonderful ways. It was very enlightening. I've never had that happen before. So I'm having to beg people to yell. The writing exercise from Monday, Julie would be happy to tell you about, right?
Yeah. I think you might need to fill in.
Okay. Do we remember what the exercise was? Why? Why is identity the ascendant or most important psychosocial issue within Erikson's stages during adolescence? Okay, why is it the most ascendant stage? Why does it come to the forefront and become an issue at adolescence? And the answer is for 2 reasons, which Erikson says. One, and both are included in the video. One is because puberty happens, and Erikson says that the physiological changes as you enter adolescence make it necessary for you to rethink who you are, because you're not the same kind of person you were before. And the second is that you have the cognitive skills to be reflective about who you are. Okay. So you can ask and answer the question, who am I? I'm taking it over for you. Sorry. So for Erikson, that combination of causes makes identity the significant issue. And it's a nice combination, because what he says is that the changes in the first domain, biology, and the changes in the second domain, the cognitive skills, coincide at least closely enough that as you deal with both of them, you get to rethink who you are. And that makes identity the primary issue. If you got both of those in some reasonably articulate way, you got 3 points. If you got one of them in a reasonably articulate way, you got 2 points. And if you talked around the topic without explaining why identity was important during adolescence rather than at some other time, then you got 1 point. And I think everybody got points. Yeah, so everybody got a point at least for staying through the end. Okay. That help? Okay. Yes. Will the videos be online?
The review.
Will the review sessions be recorded and online as they were last time? Yes. The God of the iPod willing.
Liz.
The other question that I thought you were asking is, will the, at least the audio track of the two lectures for which I was not here, will that be on? It will if I can figure out the technology for extracting the audio track and converting it to an MP3 format. If anybody knows how to do that, you're welcome to volunteer to teach me. Otherwise, I'll have to learn it myself, which will take me all night. But I will get it up there in one way or another. And I know I can do it. It's just a question of how long it's going to take. Sorry about that. Yeah, you're sitting just about far enough away that you won't get... I'll step back if I feel a cough coming. Okay. Other questions? Housekeeping or otherwise? Just to remind you, this is a basic schematic of what Erickson was talking about. And it's most important that you understand that his attempt was to describe the transaction that goes on between the person trying to make sense out of his experience or her experience across the lifespan, and that the challenges that you have to face as a person are created by the internal ground plan, the epigenetic principle, as he described it. And it just cuts out randomly, and one of the places it cuts out is right about here, and I don't understand it. So Erickson was describing the changes that take place because you are a developing human being, and those present you with challenges and opportunities, potentials, and you have to make sense out of those. And at the same time, you're living in a social environment that has co-evolved with you as a human being, so that social environment is composed of other people going through changes, and they have created a social system, typically a culture or family, community, society, that has expectations for people of different ages, people who are going through particular changes. And as you go through the predictable changes of the lifespan, the expectations for you and the opportunities for you and the restrictions placed on you by the society are going to change. And there you are in the middle between your body and your mind on one side and the society, your family, the social environment. You're trying to make sense out of all the transactions that you're having, and as you're doing that, you're constructing a set of attitudes or senses, as he calls them, about yourself and your place in the society. But it's a nicely simple and very elegant approach that Erickson describes. I find it very useful. The text tries to apply it to each of the stages that we're talking about. I think it gives you a flavor if you go through the various chapters and pull out the Erickson material. It gives you a sense of what the lifespan looks like. And in the lecture, I tried to focus specifically in the second lecture on identity and the changes that take place, particularly during adolescence, and why identity is the big topic for those of us as we move between childhood and adulthood. Yes? They will be. They're not now. But I will put them on. I should have said that. Okay. Questions about Erickson or applying or interpreting him? And the video showed up okay. I was concerned about it until I saw the first one. I mean, you could see it on the screen. That was my basic question. We thank my wife, who was the camera person, for that. Voluntarily, she did that. And Julie, who did the technical transfer to what was that? DVD. I'm recorded now. I'm a star. I'm whatever I am. Technology is fun, especially if you don't have to deal with it yourself. All right. If there are no questions particularly about Ericsson, I want to move on to technology fun. Okay, this is a, no. There we go. We get it. Okay. This one is in some version on the web. As I promised a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago now, I do want to talk about one of my other favorite theorists. And this is a man who is not described in the text at all. He's often forgotten. And I find his approach, again, compatible with Piaget and with Erickson, and I find it particularly useful in thinking about the social relationships that we have and how over time they shape the expectations and the relationships that we come to have with other people. It's a different perspective than Erickson's. As most theories are, it's either useful or not, depending on the circumstances where you're trying to apply it. It's not true or false. And the best theories are useful and help you understand what's going on. And Sullivan, I have found over the years, holds up quite well. His work is also supported, although people often don't refer to their research as supporting it because they don't think about Sullivan. What he described in the 1940s and 50s, when he was writing most actively and teaching, what he describes is quite consistent with a great deal of research on relationships that has gone on over the last 50 years. It's just that people don't refer to him, but I find it getting more and more support as I watch that literature on relationships grow. Harry Stack Sullivan was born in upstate New York in 1892 and died 57 years later in Paris on his way home from an international meeting. He's another of the developmentalists whose birthday we celebrate in my household on February 21st was his birthday. He went to medical school in Chicago. He taught in Maryland and then headed the William Allenson White Foundation, which is a psychoanalytic training institute. He founded the journal Psychiatry. You don't need to know that for an exam, but I think it's fascinating that one of his contributions as a psychiatrist was to create the most highly respected journal in that field, a journal that's still highly regarded now. It's important to me that Sullivan grew up on a dairy farm in upstate New York. Both of his parents were Irish. He, as a Sullivan, was quite Irish. And he was an only child. I think that may have been important in his focus on relationships. We refer to Sullivan's theory as an interpersonal theory. That's the title of one of the books that he actually didn't write. Sullivan has an interesting career. Because he died young and had not written, he'd written a couple of books and had an office full of manuscripts and lecture notes. After he died, a group of his colleagues got together and they formed a committee. And they wrote books and put his name on them. And one of them that I use regularly and is the basis for much of what I'll say today about him is from the interpersonal theory of psychiatry. And the first half of that book presents an interpersonal theory of development. The second half connects that theory to an understanding of psychiatric disorders. But the fun part about reading Erickson or Sullivan, I do confuse my theorists. Did you notice in the first video? Did you notice when I said what we would be talking about in the second video? That I said we would look more closely at Piaget's stages? I caught that only when I was converting it to DVD. I hope you knew the difference. You should know the difference between Piaget and Erickson. You should know the difference between Erickson and Sullivan. It's the cold speaking. It's the cold. It's not my fault. So, what happened was that Sullivan left all these lecture notes and half-finished manuscripts, and the people who had worked with him for years also collected notes from students. And this is the really frightening part. They collected notes from students who'd taken his courses, his advanced courses in psychoanalytic theory and in development, and they created a book. Can you imagine taking your notes? Let's say 10, 15 of you take your notes and present Shelton's view of development. That's really frightening. So I hope you'll burn your notes. No, nobody's going to be interested in my view of development to write a book, so that's okay. We're in no danger. But what happens is that Sullivan took his wonderful vocabulary, his love of poetry, and an Irish whimsy, and a bit of alcoholism, and he put that into all of his writing. He liked to make up words. He liked to make things sound a bit complicated. So if you try to read him, and I recommend sometime that you do at least the first half of the Interpersonal Theory of Psychiatry, it helps probably to read a little Irish poetry, and maybe some James Joyce particularly, before you tackle his books. It helps with the vocabulary. It will not help to drink before you read him. That doesn't help it get clear at all, I'm told. I've never tried it, but I'm sure it wouldn't work. So Sullivan has a very simple approach. Again, that makes it potentially quite powerful, but you also get to fill in your own details. And the first principle is that one of the things that we need to understand about development is the kinds of relationships that people experience across the lifespan. And we start, he said, with one basic relationship. We all come from a female parent, and that relationship is the first one. Most of us either start with that relationship or are given immediately to somebody else who can fill that role for us, in the case of a wet nurse or fostering or adoption. Then we gradually expand the repertoire of relationships that we participate in. So both the number of relationships increases and the variety of them increases, so that as you're moving up developmentally and out into the social world, you add perhaps another parent, and those people are different. And perhaps you add older siblings, and those people are not like either of the parents. And then as you get up into childcare or into preschool, you add peers who are not family members. Okay? So it's not too difficult to create a list of the people that you're likely to form relationships with. And Sullivan's point is that each of those relationships that is of a new type or with a different kind of person involves a new kind of role and a new kind of transaction with the people that you're developing that relationship with. So as you move up into the realm of friends, you have to learn how to be a friend, which is different from being a child of your parent. If when you're childing, you know, being the child of your parent, that's different, and your activities are different, and your expectations are different than when you're peering, when you're relating to a peer. The relationship that you have with a parent is different from the relationship you have with a teacher. The relationship you have with a teacher may be different from the relationship that you have with your parole officer when you're 18. So whatever the relationships are, we can think about them as requiring constant construction of new ways of transacting with people, because the people are going to be in different roles. And when you start off, you're relating primarily to people who are older than you, since everybody is older than you, and then gradually moving on to peers, and then when you become a big sibling, you get to relate to people who are younger than you. And as you go on through the lifespan, you may add becoming a parent yourself. The relationship that you have as a parent with your child, or as an aunt with your nephew, is different from the relationship that you have if you're on the other side of that age gap. So if you're the younger one, you behave differently than if you're the older. And as you get on up in years, you may have more and more generations younger than you to keep track of and learn to relate to. Okay? So that's the first tenet, that you're having significant relationships with an increasing number and variety of people. And as Erickson would have suggested, as you go through the lifespan, the roles that you play in those relationships are going to change, and the challenges to you are going to change. So when you're a four-year-old, the deal is to figure out how to keep in your parents' good graces and not offend them too much, you know, because you want them to like you and take care of you. When you're a parent of a four-year-old, when you're 30, the challenges are different. It's how to discipline, how to raise, how to guide the four-year-old, and that's a very, very different challenge. It's a very, very different task. Now, the second point that's important in understanding Sullivan is that in each of those relationships, you have the challenge and the potential to learn new things. So each of the relationships is different in some way than the others that have come before it. When you're thinking about relating to other adults, you have the opportunity to learn when you're engaging in that, say with teachers or with your aunts and uncles or your grandparents as a toddler. You're learning that not everybody sees you the same way your parents do. You come into a child care center and you have adults to relate to, but they may not be as old, or they may be older than your parents. And your relationship with them is not going to be the same as your parents have. They don't have history with you. They may not, the child care provider may not be responsible for you genetically, so may be less disposed to tolerate your little quirks. May be much more used to shaping children up into civilized human beings. And parents sometimes don't do a very good job of that, as some of you have noticed, thinking about old roommates you've had, whose parents obviously failed to civilize them. Okay. Most of you had good roommates. Another example where you may have the opportunity to learn something different is if you think about going into school, in elementary school, you get there and you start dealing with peers who have some experiences that are different from yours. So you have to figure out how to deal with them. And the peers create, Sullivan describes very nicely, a culture in which there are particular routines, there's particular knowledge, there are particular interests, and you have to figure out how to enter into that world that's structured by the interests of your peers. Now, some of us don't do that very well. So we come into school and everybody else is interested in baseball and hunting, and if you're a guy, and whatever it is that they're interested in, we're not interested in that. So we don't fit with the peer group very well, and we have to figure out how to relate to them in some kind of satisfying way. You're the kid who comes in without television now. How do you talk to kids whose life is based on all of the television characters and situations that they know? You're the kid who's protected you from Harry Potter. How do you engage in a conversation with your peers when everybody else has had Harry Potter and lives, breathes, and eats Harry Potter? Okay. So the peer group provides you a challenge of how to fit in to a culture that's provided and created by the peers. Some of us don't have any difficulty doing that at all, and peer relationships are easy because we share interests with them and we don't have any oddball interests that they can't appreciate and respect. And some of us have a great deal of difficulty coming into the peer setting. Some of us come into a peer setting, to expand another step, we come into a peer setting where everybody is nice and they are civilized. And so we come into that setting and they welcome us and they're tolerant of us and they respect it. And that makes your elementary school years, or if it's a high school peer culture where everybody's nice and tolerant and friendly, it makes that period of your life fairly easy. But what if you're the kid who comes into a peer group that has two or three nasties in it? How do you deal with the bully? How do you deal with a peer group who doesn't share any of your interests and not only doesn't share them but isn't interested in finding out about you? And there are peer groups like that. So there you are trying to figure out how to relate to people who clearly don't like you, but you have to spend time with them, as little as necessary, but you still have to spend time with them and figure out how they operate, what kind of transaction you can have with them that allows you to survive. Okay. So, the number and variety of relationships keeps changing. I don't want to beat that horse to death. And what you can learn is dependent on the nature of the relationship, and what challenges and opportunities there are is dependent on the relationships, the particular people that you get involved with. Now, let's extend this a little bit. Go back to the beginning. Here I am developing a relationship with my mother, and this relationship consists of her taking care of me, feeding me, diapering me, doing all of those things, keeping me warm, getting up in the middle of the night. And remember, Sullivan was writing this at a time when dads didn't do much of that, so some of us have the opportunity to learn that two parents may do that for us. So, what am I learning in that situation that I'm going to take into the next situation that I have? Particularly, let's assume that I'm being well taken care of and my parents really like me and they meet all of my needs. And then they leave me with a babysitter. This is another adult. He may even be the same age as my parents, and here I am, or there's an emergency and I get left with my uncle or my neighbor or somebody, and so here I am. What do I do in that situation? Sullivan's point is that I come into that situation expecting to be treated the same way I was treated by my parents. Aha. Now think a little Piaget. Here I come interpreting the world according to the way I have been treated. I have been constructing a set of expectations for relationship. And the people I spend almost all my time with love me, they're devoted to me, they take care of me, I don't have to worry about anything. And then now I'm with somebody else who doesn't understand my every cry, who doesn't meet my every need, who doesn't read my signals the same way. Oy vey, now what do? Think Piaget. Disequilibrium. Interpersonal disequilibrium. And that is likely to be experienced as anxiety. I may also put some curiosity and some interest there if I have a reasonably easy temperament. But what I'm going to be doing is getting anxious. I'm going to have to figure out this new person. How do you relate to this new person? And in Sullivan's view, I am constantly taking my expectations, whatever I've constructed from previous relationships, and I'm applying them in new relationships at first because that's what I know how to do. And then running into the fact that they don't work, or the other person isn't like my mother, the other person isn't like whoever it is I've been relating to who's been in that role, and I have to step back and figure out a new way of transacting. But the important piece of that for Sullivan is that I always take the expectations that I've constructed into each new relationship. And then I differentiate the relationships. Ah, there's an interesting word. Differentiate the relationships. I tend to treat everybody the same until I learn that they are different. And in Sullivan's scheme, what I'm doing is differentiating the different kinds of people and the kinds of roles they play and I play with them. And I'm creating a system, a differentiated but integrated system, in which I can quickly move, as I get older, I can quickly move from one kind of transaction to another. So that I can figure out pretty quickly what kind of role this person is in, what I need to do to have an effective relationship with that role, and how to make the relationships satisfying. So for the infant, that's an undeveloped skill. You just relate to mom, mom takes care of you or not, and you develop expectations based on how she does that. As I get older, I need to be able to treat mom differently from teacher. I need to be able to go into childcare at 3 or whenever I'm going in. I need to go in the morning, leave the mom and my typical behavior with the mom and adapt to what the teacher is expecting, which may not be easy for us. Mom lets me get away with whining. Teacher says, canon. Whining doesn't work. Teachers don't permit whining. So you have to change. And Sullivan says, an intelligent child will change. Will treat mom different. If mom permits the whining, then the kid will do it with mom, but not with the teacher who doesn't permit it. And then after saying hi to the teacher, gets to run off to the block area and join with the gang of people who are playing with blocks and has to be able to enter that social setting and behave appropriately and establish a role with the peers. So the system becomes an integrated system because the kid is constantly adding new roles and new ways of behaving. Mental health means being able to have those relationships and be able to move back and forth among them fairly quickly. Now, some people don't do as well at differentiating and integrating different roles into their lives as other people do. For example, we'll go back to the roommate situation. Some of you had parents who pick up after you and do your laundry. Right? And if you're too noisy, they go to another part of the house. And that's great. You know, you're fine. You're taken care of, and you don't bother other people because they let you do what you want. You get into a room in Buckham with another person who's been raised like that, who's expecting you, the roommate, to pick up and maybe do the laundry and do all the cleaning, and you know, I can just leave things down because all my entire life, Mom has come and picked them up. You know, and if I make too much noise, then you should go someplace else. You can't engage in that role with the roommate the same way you engage in it with Mom. There are people who don't make that switch very easily. Or here's another one that some of you are a little closer to, perhaps. So, guys, you've had a relationship with an adult woman, and it's been a good one. She loves you, takes care of you, reads your mind, picks up after you, makes sure that you have your cough medicine and you have a cold or whatever else. And then you have, as you get up into your perhaps 20s, another relationship, but this one is a little different. This one involves romance, sex, coupling, and you treat your new partner the same way you treated your mom, and you expect to be, except for the sex, and you, I hope, and you expect that new partner to fill the role the same way your mother does, and if she's a fool, she'll fall for that. She'll take care of you, because mothering is a nice role for women, and she will take care of you and pick up your socks and do your laundry and put it away and all of that stuff that as a peer, an equal partner, she perhaps should negotiate with you. If she doesn't, at the beginning, and you let her treat you like Mom, then 10 years later, you'll be renegotiating that relationship, and she will be telling you you're a little boy, and you're not grown up, and you better pull your own weight around here, or you're going to be looking at her backside as she walks out with the two kids. Okay. Because relationships between equal partners, which are the kind you want to couple with, are not based on the same expectations that exist between parent and child. But some of us have difficulty doing that differentiation. And the more difficulty we have, the less likely we are to be successful in the peer-partner relationship. Okay? All right, let me move a bit on in Sullivan. Because he also has another part to his developmental scheme, and that is this one. Sullivan, because he was a psychiatrist, he was interested in how relationships go awry and what happens in the second half of his book, The Interpersonal Theory of Psychiatry, is that he describes the ways in which relationships can make you crazy. How mothers create schizophrenics. How the peer group can create a victim. How a series of relationships that you have that make you anxious can make you neurotic. Now, to some extent, that is the least satisfying part of his thinking, in part because it is 50 years out of date. You're not going to make a schizophrenic under most circumstances unless there's a genetic loading for schizophrenia. We know that. We didn't know that back when he was writing. So the part about how relationships can make you, can lead directly to the various psychiatric disorders is you can skip that part. It's interesting, but it's not very useful in modern day psychiatry. The other part of it, though, is interesting and quite useful, which is how having a psychiatric disorder of a particular sort affects your relationships. And that was fun because he describes in wonderful detail what it is like to live with an obsessive compulsive, what it's like to live with somebody who is incredibly neurotic, and how the neurosis changes all the relationships, how it shapes them, and how being a schizophrenic makes all of your other relationships different, how it affects relationships. That part is quite interesting because it forces you to think about the transaction that's going on between somebody whose thinking is weird and the other people who are trying to have a normal relationship with the person. So that part of it's fun. On the way to getting there, he describes development in terms of the interpersonal needs that people have. He says these are built into people, and there are three of them, and they appear at somewhat different points in our development, and they change the way we relate to people. So it's not just that the number and variety of relationships that we have increases. It's that we are also experiencing different interpersonal needs that we are trying to satisfy in one or more of those relationships. And this is the set of needs that he describes, and this is up on the web. And the first of those needs he calls security. Excuse me. Sullivan argues that all human beings have a need for security, and that we're born with that, and that that is the need that infants and toddlers and children are trying to satisfy in every relationship. They are trying to create transactions and relationships with everybody that they're interacting with that are comfortable, and particularly that do not make them anxious. And the way we know that we are not secure is that we feel anxious. Anxiety is a negative emotion. And just as a parenthesis, let me point out that many of us use the word anxious when we don't mean that word. It's one of the more common mistakes, both in speaking and in writing. But in mental health and in psychiatry and psychology, it's a problem. When people say they're anxious to go home for Thanksgiving, my tendency as a mental health person is to say, oh, why are you anxious? And the person says, I'm not anxious. Well, you just said you were anxious. You were anxious to go home. What the person means is eager. I'm looking forward to it. I'm eager. When you say anxious, you mean you have dread. You have feelings that are negative. And that's what Sullivan is referring to here. Anxiety, in his view, we feel any time we're in a relationship or trying to create a relationship and are not feeling secure about that. So when we're not sure what's going on, when we don't think the other person likes us, when we don't know how to behave, we're in that state of disequilibrium in a relationship, we feel anxious. And Sullivan says that's natural and normal. Babies feel anxious when the parent is not taking care of them appropriately. Babies feel anxious when we don't come to change their diapers, when we don't feed them, when they get hungry, or when we threaten not to feed them. If you don't eat your peas, I'm going to take all the food away and send you home to bed, send you to bed without the rest of your dinner, without dessert, and probably not feed you for the next 5 days. Okay. That makes a kid anxious. Now, the value of anxiety is that when we're not feeling comfortable and secure in a particular relationship, we work to figure out what's going on. How do I behave with this person to make this relationship secure? So I might learn that if I'm going to be secure in my relationship with a parent, that I need to state my needs clearly. I need to take care of myself as much as I can. I need to remember my mother's birthday. I may need to make sure that I give her a hug and a kiss whenever we part or whenever we come back. I might learn those things. And that might make the relationship secure. I need to figure out when she's threatening and when she's really mad. I need to know and figure out when she's scared, because then I want to be scared too. I want to make sure that I'm doing the things that she expects me to do. Because every time she looks unhappy, every time she threatens, every time she growls, that makes me anxious, because there's an implicit threat. She won't love me. She won't take care of me. So in our relationships, Sullivan says, we're always trying to make the significant relationships secure. And as we're trying to make it secure, we're figuring out how to relate to that person to keep that person happy and comfortable in the relationship with us. And we may go through some not very nice behaviors to make the person stick with us. Sibling rivalry is wonderful. Some of you have siblings, and you compete for a parent's attention. You want the parent to think that you're better than the other person, than your sibling. Some of you feel like your parent does think the other person is superior, and that makes you anxious. It would be interesting to look to see what the other sibling does to make the parents think that. Yep. So in Sullivan's view, anxiety drives us to try to figure out how to make the relationship secure. He gave us, it was on the other overhead, it was misspelled, but the word is significant. Some of you use the term significant other. Yeah. Sullivan used that throughout his writing. It's not a 21st century coinage. In fact, he took it from a sociologist named George Herbert Mead, who wrote about significant others. And Sullivan picked up his phraseology for that. And the definition of a significant other, a significant relationship, in Sullivan's view, is one that can make you anxious. If somebody can make you anxious, then the relationship is probably significant, if the potential is there. If the other person doesn't matter, you can let it go. It's probably not a significant relationship. But the significant ones are the ones we're most likely to feel anxious in, or where the potential is greatest. Parents use that potential for anxiety to socialize children. They tell you what to do to be comfortable and secure in their relationship with them. They will love you if you do this, if you don't do that, then the relationship will be fine. And as long as you do what they're telling you to do, you're fine. And they approve, and they tell you that by smiling and hugging you and doing all those nice things for you. But if you don't do them, then the threat of their disapproval causes anxiety, and we shape ourselves up if we can. What do we do when a relationship is too anxious? We leave it. if you bend yourself out of shape to try to make the relationship comfortable and secure, and you can't do that, eventually you bail. Kids run away from home because the parent is too anxiety producing. Kids get sick at school because their relationship with the teacher is not comfortable and secure. So they get a tummy ache so they can go lie down in the nurse's room because the nurse makes them feel secure. But the classroom is too anxious a place. So they bail. They find a place where they can be comfortable. Couples make each other anxious for years and years and years. And eventually they either kill each other, or one of them does, or they bail. I can't be with you. The situation is too anxious, so I become a workaholic and stay home all the time. I mean, stay at work all the time. I never come home. If a relationship creates more anxiety than you can tolerate, or more than you think is appropriate in the situation, then you tend to avoid the relationship. Okay. Now, fair enough? Reasonable place to start? Sullivan says that somewhere along toward the end of childhood, a new interpersonal need appears for the first time. And he describes that as intimacy. The intimacy that he's describing is the intimacy of a close interpersonal relationship in which you are emotionally close with the other person, in which you feel that you're being understood and accepted, that you matter to the other person, and that that's reciprocal. And you can share the thoughts and feelings that you have with that person. That person can actually know you as a human being. That's what he means by intimacy. He's not describing sexual intimacy. Even to use the phrase sexual intimacy means we have to distinguish sexual contact from real intimacy, which is just intimacy, and that's the emotional connectedness that people have. When you feel that somebody understands you, that you can tell them what they think, what you think, they will understand you, or they'll at least try to. They like you, they accept you, and it's mutual. And Sullivan says that doesn't exist for children. It requires the kind of reflectivity and interest in your own emotions that come along with the end of childhood and the beginning of adolescence. That's interesting that he's picked up on the same one of the same characteristics that Erikson describes at the beginning of adolescence, and that is the reflective ability, the cognitive ability. But Sullivan is saying that that cognitive ability of being reflective allows you to understand or begin to understand your own emotions and other people's. And you become what we sometimes call a junior psychologist. You begin to understand somewhere along 10, 11, 12 years old that other people have things going on in their heads. They have thoughts and feelings, and you can understand them. And you do too. And that other people can't understand them unless you try to express them. So part of the challenge as we move up toward adolescence is figuring out what's going on in our heads and expressing that to somebody else and finding somebody else who gives a shit. So, and who's not going to threaten us if we tell them how we feel? Who's not going to reject us if we tell them how we feel? So, little kids have friendships that are based on similar interests and activities that they enjoy together and sort of proximity. They're in the same neighborhood, so they become friends. They're in the same school class, so they become friends. As kids begin to feel this new interpersonal need, they begin to engage in friendship in a different way. they're more interested in talking about themselves and the other person. They ask different kinds of questions. And the challenge becomes how to communicate with each other about the new ideas and thoughts that you're having in a way that creates friendship and trust rather than gives the other kid something to laugh at. Now, we don't immediately experience interpersonal intimacy. That takes a long time for most of us to develop. What we experience instead is the feeling of not having it. And not having it comes along in the form of loneliness, of isolation. So as I'm getting up into adolescence and I want to have intimacy, that's the need that I'm feeling, then I start looking for relationships in which I can share my feelings and where I can have somebody who's comfortable to talk to. And that takes exercise. It's a skill that we practice. When we're not feeling intimate, then we feel lonely. Sullivan argues that little kids feel bored when they don't have anybody to play with or nobody to do something with, but they don't feel lonely because they don't yet experience the feeling, the need for intimacy. But as we move up through adolescence, intimacy with another person becomes important. So we practice that. The problem with practicing intimacy is that it does expose us to anxiety. People find it difficult to put their thoughts and feelings into words, particularly face to face with a friend. But if the friendship is fairly strong and solid and the other person is a good match for you and is also feeling the desire for intimacy, then instead of playing sorting your baseball cards all afternoon, you can actually talk about what's going on in your life. And that's what it requires to create an intimate relationship. When you have developed intimacy, then you understand the difference between that and non-intimate friendships. You may have lots of friendships. You may have lots of people to do things with. You may have good buddies, but with whom you're not intimate. You don't really talk about how you feel. You're not able to be yourself unguardedly with that person. One of the experiences of loneliness that many of us have had is coming to a place like UVM and going to what we euphemistically call mixers. Not where you mix your booze, but where you mix people together, right? And they're supposed to have conversations that let them get acquainted with each other. And some of you have been to those and you stand there sort of on the sidelines and you watch all these other people engage in really petty, shallow conversations, and they're finding out about each other, and that's important. And what you really want to have is somebody who's feeling the same way you are, whatever that might be, and there's nobody there who's doing anything more than trying to compete with you to get the attention of somebody there and cutting you out of the conversation and not really interested in you as a person. So we feel lonely. Even in the middle of a crowd. David Riesman, a sociologist back in the 1960s, wrote a book called The Lonely Crowd. And he describes society, our society particularly, as characterized by being in crowds a lot, but not knowing anybody, and not really having intimate relationships with people. And it's possible to have very close relationships with people that are not intimate. People get married when they in fact don't have an intimate relationship. People work with people for years and never develop an intimate relationship with them. So intimacy is not automatic. It's a skill that you have to learn and it takes time. And both people have to be interested in an intimate relationship. Elaborate just briefly on that by Lightstone. lights. Give me lights. There we go. Sullivan describes intimate relationships. Julie, would you remind me to make an overhead of this point? Sullivan says that truly intimate relationships have four characteristics. And one of those is that they're between equals. Okay. So there's equality in the relationship. So to be truly intimate, a relationship is not going to be with somebody who's in a different developmental stage than you are. So if you're an adolescent, it's probably going to be an intimate relationship with another adolescent. If you're an adult, it's going to be with another adult. But intimate relationships are collaborative. That means that both people are working on the intimacy in the relationship and the activities that the couple or the pair are engaging in. And what they're doing is developing activities and a language to share with each other, an understanding that they are creating together. One way to think about what he's describing is a transaction that two people are involved in. And in the intimate relationship, you're working as equals and you're creating understanding together. And the understanding is shared. That means they're mutual and they're reciprocal. Mutual means that both people have to be involved in the relationship for it to be intimate. And reciprocal means that the different roles that might be played in the relationship are interchangeable. For example, often in an intimate relationship, one of us has problems and a concern. And in many intimate relationships or relationships that are trying to be intimate, if one person who is always expressing his or her concerns, the fears, the worries, the vulnerabilities, and the other person never does that, that's not a reciprocal relationship. Some of us stay in close relationships for a long time that are not reciprocal, where we may do the expressing, we're the one who raises all the questions, the other person is a good listener, but we can't flip those roles and do it reciprocally. So you may have somebody who's a great listener, and you can tell him or her everything you want and get a good audience, but that person never actually tells you anything. Or you may be with somebody who's really a great teller and is happy to tell you everything he or she is concerned about and ask your advice about all kinds of things. But when you try to reciprocate and you have something that you want to tell the other person doesn't listen. So you may be a good listener, the other person is a good teller, but you can't switch those. Okay. So an intimate relationship, he says, eventually works to become equal, collaborative, mutual, reciprocal, and add to that secure. Because in the meeting of now two interpersonal needs, we also have the need for security, which is still there. So in an intimate relationship, it also needs to be secure if that relationship is going to last. And intimate relationships don't have to last, just that when we get that experience with somebody and it really is equal, collaborative, reciprocal, and mutual, we want to keep it. Those are good relationships, particularly if they make us secure. But that attempt to create intimate relationships can make us really anxious. And my very favorite illustration of that is from the great psychologist and philosopher, Charles Schulz. So, in one of his Sunday panels many years ago, he shows Charlie Brown, minding his own business, and along comes Lucy. And Lucy says, you know, she's a peer, she's the same age, "Charlie, what's your deepest, fondest wish?" Now that is a request, an invitation to intimate communication, right? You're going to answer that question, what's your deepest, fondest wish? You have to dig deep and you have to put it out there for the other person. So she's inviting an intimate relationship. And Charlie Brown isn't eager to take that bait. Okay, he says, I can't tell you. You'd laugh. And what happens, how do you feel when somebody laughs at you? Anxious. Okay. Laughing at somebody doesn't make them secure. It's not a secure relationship. You laugh with people. And then you can create intimacy, but not at them. Not making fun of them for what they think or feel. So she says, okay, no, I really want to know, Charlie Brown. And he says, well, no, you'd tell other kids. And they'd laugh. Okay, so he's got it figured out. And then she puts the hook in. She says, let's make this reciprocal. You tell me your deepest, fondest wish, and I'll tell you mine. So, oh, it's going to be reciprocal. And I promise I won't laugh. Now, Charlie Brown is the quintessential young adolescent. So this interchange between them is hitting his interpersonal needs very clearly. So he says something that is also straight out of Erikson, the identity bit. What is his deepest, fondest wish? Do any of you remember it? Do you know what Charlie Brown's deepest, fondest wish is? He's always wanted to be called Flash. Okay. Who is the least Flash kid in all of comics? Charlie Brown. He is not Flash. What he's described is a real deep identity desire. And what does Lucy do? She laughs. She goes cartwheeling across the landscape, yelling at everybody that this is the most ridiculous thing she's ever heard. What would an intimate person have done? Gee, that's really interesting, Charlie. I've kind of wanted something like that too. And you'd share it and make it mutual and reciprocal, and you would keep it a secret because you know other kids would laugh. What Charlie Brown is going to do next time somebody invites him to an intimate communication is hide. He's not going it. Well, because he's Charlie Brown, he probably will keep it. It's like kicking the football, right? He just keeps trying because that's who Charlie Brown is. But the rest of us, real people, would hide. And we'll see if we can come out of our shell on Wednesday.